de lunes a jueves.
The Safari Park. You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in cheers and applause? I think not. You know, there's a video making the rounds on social media. Maybe you've seen it. There's no audio, and it looks like it was shot from a security camera. The perspective is from above, and we see a man and a woman strolling down a wide street. Looks like summertime. They wear light clothing, and the trees are full. But in the background is a road above a grassy berm. And suddenly, from the road appears a vehicle tire with the wheel still inside. It hurtles towards the camera and the male and female strollers. The tire takes one, two, three long and mighty bounces and lands squarely on the back of the guy's head. The force of the blow surely broke his neck, and the energy of the strike knocks him face first to the asphalt with such force, his body gets bowed like a hammock and his feet fly up behind him as he face plants. It looks like he's doing the worm. They claim the guy lived, but I'm not so sure. His female companion claps a hand over her mouth in shock and horror, then bends down to attend to him. After flattening the guy, the tire keeps rolling, and some bystander chases it and retrieves it for what, a citizen's arrest? Now, call me a sicko, but when I saw that video, I could not stop laughing. And I was not alone in finding powerful humor in some stranger's misfortune. Many comments beneath the video expressed the same gut-busting amusement that I'd found. Of course, others excoriated us for being so insensitive. Humor is incredibly subjective. You may recall some years back, some people were actually recorded laughing at Dane Cook. And people tend to argue as heatedly about what's funny as they do about politics, don't they? Comedy has been studied by shitloads of people. They try to analyze it, synthesize it, to even teach it. Los Angeles is full of comedy schools, staffed by really, really unfunny people, and they consistently graduate more unfunny, annoying people, people who think puns are funny. Why are great comedians funny? Who the fuck knows? A couple of elements are necessary for things to be funny. One is surprise. And so back to the killer tire video. The first 20 seconds or so, you think, why am I watching this boring shit? And then you notice that big-ass tire, which should have a name, and that name is maybe Fate or Destiny, bearing down on that poor son of a bitch. And when you notice the tire, it's already on its second big bounce, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see where it's likely to land. And some viewers want to scream, hey, look out! Whereas myself and the rest of the sick fuck squad are thinking, shh, keep walking, buddy, keep walking. You have a big surprise sneaking up on you. About 100 pounds of hard rubber and steel that wants to lay some Newtonian principles at the base of your skull. So surprise is a key element of funny. The other is misfortune. But it's only funny if it's unexpected and short. If it's prolonged, it's no longer funny. Now everybody thinks that's sick. Nobody wants to watch torture or suffering. But almost everybody wants to see some guy slip on a banana peel, or step on a rake and smack his head with the handle, or fall into a manhole. Short, fast, surprise, misfortune. They call them sight gags or pratfalls, and comics were probably doing them in front of the pharaohs. The undisputed kings of physical comedy were the Three Stooges. I've never met a guy who doesn't like the Stooges, and I've never met a female who did. In fact, the Stooges could function as an infallible test to determine the birth sex of a transgender. I'd bet everything I own Caitlyn Jenner still laughs at the Stooges, and Chaz Bono never will. And so this show is about destiny and fate, and is there any way we can possibly influence those things? As Jim Morrison said, no one here gets out alive. And you just never know when you think you're perfectly safe. Some truck tire, perhaps guided by karmic forces, is dispatched to put your lights out. Or a plane falls out of the sky and crushes your house. I once saw a very similar situation on a Los Angeles freeway to the video I described. A big rig truck wheel just flew like it had been shot out of a cannon and landed on the windshield of a VW two lanes over from me. The wheel was so heavy it just crushed the front end of that bug and stopped it cold. At that time, or even later, I didn't think it was the least bit funny. They say tragedy plus time equals comedy. I think proximity is a part of the equation, too. Watching some stranger on a silent video whose face cannot be discerned removes a lot of the humanity from it. They say it's a lot easier to shoot someone at 100 yards than kill them with your bare hands. So after I stopped laughing, I began to wonder, how many times in our lives do we knowingly or unknowingly cheat death? My father narrowly missed being crushed by a suicide jumper on a Manhattan street. The guy leaped from a very high floor and practically exploded at his feet. And his story popped right in my head on a winter's day many years later, when about a 5-foot icicle falling from a skyscraper, as thick around as your leg, missed my head by a hair. I was lucky. Unlike the construction worker who made the news soon after my icicle incident. The guy was working steel only 2 or 3 stories up and lost his balance. But it was his lucky day. Beneath him was a huge mound of sand to break his fall. But in the last nanosecond, his luck ran out. Somebody had left a pry bar vertically embedded in the sand. The steel worker landed on it. It went straight up his ass and out his collarbone. He became a human kebab. When your number is up, it's up. But some people now live their lives as if they have some control over fate. They think they can, with sufficient prep and unreasonable caution, maybe live indefinitely. The truth is, most people croak rather slowly in a hospital bed with tubes in every orifice. Who the fuck wants that? How ignominious, how unheroic, pedestrian, and boring. I call these people the helmet people, and the most important thing in their life is safety. The champion practitioners are often new mothers. When my kid was in nursery school, she once had a play date with some other kid, and this kid's mom had turned their home into a rubber room. Not only was the corner of every piece of furniture covered in thick foam rubber, she had mover's blankets pinned to all the walls in case little Chloe should bump into one. And people wonder where snowflakes come from. They're manufactured by fucked-up parents and then finished and polished by even more fucked-up teachers. Oh, wait, did I use an offensive term? I think they prefer educators, 'cause as regular dojo visitors know, 4-syllable words are always better than 2-syllable words. By the way, there was absolutely nothing wrong with that kid who lived in a rubber house. But I bet there is now. I even asked her crazy mom why her home was thusly padded. I could see the question was not a welcome one. Her face tightened and her eyes narrowed as she forced an angry smile and said, "We choose to provide a safe environment for Chloe." Just to screw with her, I said, "Isn't that something?" That's another stock verbal judo phrase regular dojo members know. And then I said, "Were you aware that some types of foam cushioning have been known to emit vapors that can be carcinogenic?" The color drained from her face. The parental chit-chat was over, and she couldn't wait to get me gone so she could go Google my statement, which I had pulled straight out of my ass. That was a number of years ago. And minutes before this show, I finally Googled it myself, and it's true. She must have run around that place like the Tasmanian devil, ripping foam off every corner. Maybe she whistled up a hazmat team to do a proper job. Our lives are one continuous 24-hour crapshoot. Will that asshole driving while texting not see the light and T-bone you at the intersection? Might your brakes fail on the mountain downgrade? When you have lunch, what guarantee is there that some psycho chef won't lace your burger with ricin? Hell, even plain old spoiled food can kill you. No psycho needed, just incompetence. And when you tuck yourself in bed at the end of the day and reach for the lamp to turn it off, what if that wiring is frayed and a 20-ampere fault fries you into the big sleep? You never know. And when you think you are more likely to be safe, as in the care of so-called medical professionals, you may never be in more danger. Actuaries will tell you hospitals are the most dangerous places on earth. You are 10 times more likely to get dead in a hospital than in a car wreck. Every year in the U.S. alone, preventable medical errors kill some 440,000 people. That's a whopper of a number. Everybody knows somebody who went in for a routine procedure, right? A rotator cuff or appendix or tonsillectomy, and never came home. Your humble host has had a few near misses with mortality, as most of us do. In the circumstances one might expect, right? Freeway mayhem, or teenage stunts, or waterfront bars. But there was an incident with a so-called medical professional that nearly put my lights out. I was about 19. 19 is a magical age. Because for most guys, at age 19, we are convinced that we are immortal, impervious to any and all peril, which is why 19 is the average age of those who die in combat. There are no mysteries, are there? And I was 19 when my wisdom teeth began to give me trouble. I had no idea of the wisdom I was about to garner from those teeth. It was deep winter in New York City, Queens, to be more precise, when all turns gray and cold and gloomy. The family dentist was wisely vacationing in the Bahamas, and his office referred me to somebody else. I recall my father urging me to allow him to accompany me to this strange dentist. I considered his offer a slur on my manhood. Only a pussy needs his daddy to take him to the dentist. I well recall the look on Dad's face as I headed out the door. He probably uttered a silent prayer for me. Like any place, Queens has nicer areas and not-so-nice ones. This guy's offices were in a shitty area near an elevated subway line. The skies were heavy with snow. The car radio told me a blizzard was on its way. Did I give a shit? No. I was 19 and bulletproof. As I parked my car, it was already snowing pretty hard. The dentist's office was on the second floor above a Botanica. Those are weird little shops that sell supplies for practitioners of Santeria. That's a sort of a Caribbean magic, some say an offshoot of voodoo. Well, I'd have been better off heading in there and buying a spell or magic candle for my teeth. The elevator was broken, so I climbed a tall flight of steep stairs. A heavily mascaraed receptionist/hygienist greeted me. She had a wad of gum in her mouth.
Can I help yous?
I looked over my shoulder. In parts of New York, yous is the plural of you, but I was the only one standing there. So I told her I was there to see the doctor about my wisdom teeth. Then I asked her how long the elevator had been broken.
Years,
was her answer. Not a good sign. But hey, I was 19. What the fuck did I need with an elevator? If I had to, I could climb the building exterior like King Kong. Pretty soon, I'm sitting in the torture chair, and in walks this clown who looked like a character from Boogie Nights. I thought, oh, here's Captain Tightpants. He's wearing a silk print shirt open to his navel, and his slacks fit him like a tourniquet. He seemed jumpy and distracted. He kept looking at the door as if he was expecting one of Tony Spumante's collection men. I had a feeling I should leave. But being 19, and though I was certain I should have a big yellow S on my chest and a red cape on my back, I just didn't want to, what, make a scene, right? Maybe hurt somebody's feelings. Now let's take a fast detour to the Take No Shit Dojo right now. I would venture to guess that more people have wound up dead, disabled, mugged, swindled, or screwed over for that stupid reason than any other. We just don't want to make a scene. And so when we're alone and an elevator opens and some creep steps in, instead of heeding our instincts and exiting, we remain and become a victim. Not wanting to make a scene will make us losers, not only in life-threatening situations, but confrontations and negotiations over even mundane things. We're afraid to look petty or demanding or cheap, and so we allow ourselves to be fleeced or manipulated by assholes. And so we wind up with a shitty financing deal on an automobile or a $200 bottle of wine at that ritzy restaurant when our taste buds max out at $50, or a case of Girl Scout cookies we neither need nor want, or a cheeseburger that arrived with no cheese, but we eat it anyway. Hell, how many brides and grooms find themselves standing at the altar of doom, about to wreck their lives because they fear a few moments of perceived embarrassment. When in doubt, jilt, baby, jilt. And every time we allow ourselves to be manipulated in some way, almost always because of that don't make a scene impulse, we get screwed. Now, back in the dentist chair, he had the most hideous muzak you ever heard playing through a speaker that buzzed, and every few minutes, the whole fucking building would shudder and shake as the elevated subway train rolled by. He looks at my mouth and says, "Yeah, you got two impacted wisdom teeth. You want me to take them out?" "What? You got two impacted wisdom teeth. Want me to take them out for you?" "Yeah, okay." And so he starts working. And he pulls out some needles that look like something you'd use to inject a rhinoceros. They're immense. And starts jabbing them into my gums. "Ah! What's the matter?" he asks me. And I say, "Hey, I've only had a couple of cavities filled before. And my regular dentist usually gives me some gas." "Shit! Yes! I forgot. Sorry." Now, I know I should run from this fucking asshole. But I was 19 and bulletproof and didn't want to make a scene. Before he puts the gas on me, I ask him how long it will take to pull these teeth. "Oh, we ain't pulling nothing. This is oral surgery. We gotta cut them out. You wanna get knocked out completely or just like La La Land?" I opted for La La Land. That may have been my solitary smart choice that day. Years later, I learned that often the most dangerous part of any surgery is the anesthesia. A buddy's father went under the knife for a knee replacement, another routine procedure. When the guy woke up, he had gained a new knee, but lost about 50 IQ points. They fucked up the dosage and fried his brain. That's another tip from the dojo senseis. Whenever possible, opt for the local anesthesia. So the gas goes on and he goes back to work with the needles, needle after needle after needle. Pretty soon, I not only can't feel my mouth, I'm not sure my head is still attached to my spine. But I had a semblance of awareness. I still kinda knew what was going on. He hooks one of those suction tubes on my mouth to keep me from drowning in my own saliva. And above the muzak and the sound of a scalpel sawing through my flesh, I heard the tap-tap of high heels across his cheesy linoleum floor. They sounded pointy. These were not the corrugated white rubber wedgies worn by the gum-chewing hygienist. And the heels clocked with a purpose. "Hey, Angie, I'm a little busy, okay?"
"Marie, I need the rent money now."
Hey, come on, I can bring it to the apartment on my way home tonight. And I realize this fucking cretin with his hands in my mouth is Jackson Heights' answer to Hugh Hefner. This rent-demanding bimbo in heels is his paramour.
That's what you said last week, Maury, but it ain't cutting it with the landlord. I need it now.
For Christ's sakes, Angie, my wallet's in my back pocket. Should be enough in there to cover it. And as this fucktard dentist has his hands in my mouth, he's contorting his body so Angie can fish his wallet out of his pants.
I can't get it. Your pants are so goddamn tight.
Oh, for Christ's sakes. He stops working on me, throws the bloody scalpel on the instrument tray, pulls his wallet from his ass pocket, peels off a bunch of filthy, crawling with God knows what germs, $100 bills, and slaps them into Angie's outstretched, zircon-encrusted fingers. She says nothing, and I hear the retreat of her heels. He looks at me and says, "Fucking women, huh?" and sticks his filthy hands back into my mouth. Even though I was high as a kite, I knew this would have repercussions. But I was too high to care. After a while, a long while, he finished up. When I sat up in his chair, I looked out the window and could barely see the street. It was a whiteout. The predicted blizzard had arrived, and it was no sissy. Miss Mascara led me to a place to lie down until the drugs wore off. It was like a tiny closet, maybe 6 feet by 3 feet, with a vinyl pad on a wooden platform. Overhead hung a single dim light bulb. The creep factor was over the moon. There wasn't even a magazine in there, not that you could read anything by 15 watts. I really felt like shit, and knew getting home with a foot of fresh snow might be problematic. So I asked Miss Mascara to call me a cab. After some time, I don't know how long, she came back, opened the door, and told me I could go now. I asked her if the cab was waiting.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. I'll call you one now.
Feeling was beginning to return to my face and head. And that feeling was pain. I wasn't going to stay in that shithole another minute. I left. I stood at the top of the long, steep staircase. I still felt dizzy from all those drugs. When I woke up at the bottom, some guy was slapping my face. I was looking at one of those yellow pails and Johnny mops. The janitor had found me. As he helped me to my feet, he says,
"Hey, Mango, you on drugs?"
"Yeah, that asshole dentist drugs." Everything hurt, especially my head. I stepped outside. It was getting dark, and the normally busy Roosevelt Avenue was eerily quiet. The snow was so thick it dampened all the sounds. I found my car. It had been plowed in. There was a wall of snow against it to the roofline. I started cursing, but facial movement hurt too much. I recalled wishing I'd allowed my dad to accompany me. Already, my wisdom teeth were making me wiser. With gloveless hands, I brushed the snow off the trunk, where inside I kept one of those little green folding GI shovels and went to work. It was like shoveling snow with an ice cream scoop. Eventually, I dug the car out. When I got in and fired it up, I took a look at myself in the rearview mirror. That bastard didn't just extract teeth. He performed a head transplant. My eyes looked as if they were stuck in a pumpkin. How could my head be this swollen and not explode? It felt as if it were about to. Of course, a powerful infection grabbed me because of that fucktard dentist's hygiene or lack of it. And I did not, could not, get out of bed for 10 days. They pumped massive dosages of antibiotics into me. Eating was out of the question. At 19, I was not a bulky dude, and when I lost an additional 15 or 20 pounds, I looked like I'd just escaped from Dachau. When I was finally ambulatory again, One of my first stops was Tony Spumante's. I had never seen fear on Tony's face, but when he opened his front door to let me in, I did.
Maron, what the fuck happened to you?
We sat down. Tony poured me a big amaretto and I told him the whole ugly story. When I finished, Tony lit up a cool. You hot-headed bastard. You sure you're not Sicilian? Why don't you listen to your old man? I had no answer for Tony. How about I send Mikey over there, throw him a beating. When he's done, that dentist might look as shitty as you do, but I can't guarantee. Fuck it, Tony. Let's just go get some clams. There was a clam joint we liked out in Howard Beach. Gotti country. We hopped in Tony's coupe de ville, and away we went. There was still gray slush in the gutters along Cross Bay Boulevard. Night was falling, with a light drizzle, throwing a blur on the red taillights in front of us as the wipers swept the caddy's windshield. Tony, in a subtle but unmistakable gesture of his fondness for me, put country music on his stereo instead of the usual Sinatra or Tony Bennett. The world was looking right again, and I was damn glad of it. My head was back to normal size. The pain had stopped. I still looked like a starvation victim, but a couple of plates of linguine and clam sauce at Lenny's would put a few pounds back on my bony frame. And at the restaurant, you never knew who you might meet. Some wise guys from another crew, or maybe some pointy chicks, or as Tony called them, cushionettes. Adventure was just down the road. And so, my friends, as you voyage through this life, and who's to say if it's the only one, we have zero control over falling airplanes, hurtling truck tires, runaway trains, and such. But when we find ourselves in a situation, any situation, that feels wrong, remember, take a deep breath, and then make that scene, a big one if need be. It can change your destiny. Thanks for stopping by the dojo, right here at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. Surf over to thatlarryshow.com and click that Patreon button and subscribe for rewards and bonus episodes. We'll reveal that no cover charge, no minimum, convenient to everyone, can't miss venue for meeting chicks in the next bonus episode. We'll see you next time. And until then, take no shit.